As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The race is on, and with the Formula One season in full swing, there's been plenty of talk about the success stories. But there have also been some disappointments, with Fernando Alonso and Alpine among those having a difficult start to the season. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to explain why and discuss some of the other strugglers are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Well, Scott, hello. You're back in your cupboard again. Is that where you regularly live now after your recent back injury?
No, my back's all fine. I'm good, fit as a fiddle again. This is just because I have my little setup in here when I'm recording voiceovers for the race YouTube channel, and the podcast that we did from here the other episode was so pleasant doing it stood up. I thought I'd come back for more, but the actual honest answer is that I've got limited room in my flat. And my desk is currently overrun with sim racing equipment, and I didn't have time to take that all down before we recorded this podcast. So laziness is the reason I am in my cupboard.
Mark Hughes, you're having a bit of fun, aren't you? Because you're heading to Portugal shortly, but you've been having the fun of travelling in COVID times with all sorts of fun forms and bureaucracy and weird routes to be factored in.
Yeah, it's not the most straightforward of things to do to travel at the moment, as you can probably appreciate. And to get from Manchester to Faro for the Portuguese Grand Prix involves me going to Amsterdam, Dusseldorf, and then Faro. But in order to get the Dusseldorf to Faro flight, which is very early in the Wednesday morning, I have to arrive in Dusseldorf on Tuesday night. Which means stepping out of the airport to stay in a hotel, which means technically being in Germany, and they don't want people in Germany from outside unless there's an absolute necessity to do so. So there's a lot of form filling involved. In fact, there's three lots of form filling involved just to get there, because there's three. I'm going through three different countries. So yes, it's not straightforward. And then there's always late flight cancellations because not enough people have booked them, so the airlines cancel the flights. And one of those things has happened on my return flight, and that has to all be rerouted. And yeah, so that's just logistical stuff that's going on in the background. Very boring, really.
Fun and games. But still, it's nice that we're among the people who are fortunate enough to be able to get out and about a little bit and travel a little. So it's a small price to pay, but it does create some headaches. Well, let's crack on with it. Mark, we saw Fernando Alonso get that first point of his comeback at Imola. He had a pretty difficult race. I'm sure we can be confident he'll be back on top form once he's had a bit more time in the car. But why do you think Alpine's made such an unconvincing start to this season?
It's just not a very good car at the moment. It looks pretty aero inefficient. Its straight line speeds aren't that great. It's got pretty iffy traction, and it's got some shortfall in a specific speed range of corners, medium speed corners, even though it works okay in slow and high speed. So that suggests there's some sort of aero separation issue going on somewhere, which I'm sure they'll find. But it's just not that great a car as things stand at the moment. So you lay a lot to do there.
It's gradually looks less and less convincing, I have to say. I've seen it obviously in Bahrain and testing the race weekend down at Imola, and it's always looked a bit floaty, as I like to call it, as in when you've got a car that's not terribly balanced or anything, but just doesn't look really, really planted with that downforce. And it's kind of looked more and more like that. It was a really noticeable watch down at Acqua Minerale. Just wasn't a car that the drivers could really commit in the same way with. But Scott, we know they've had a few problems over the winter. What do we actually know exactly about the detail of the struggles they've had?
Well, basically, they went into winter testing knowing that they'd had a bad winter. So everything that we saw at testing, you remember, it feels like so much longer ago now. It was only a few weeks back, but we were saying after Bahrain, it was only 3 days, so it was difficult to really get a handle on things. But we were saying it was Alpine and Aston Martin were the two that just seemed most difficult to get a real read on. And Aston Martin was because a lot of that was unreliability. They hadn't done as much running. And Alpine, it was just kind of, for me anyway, it was like watching a team where you're like, well, they must be holding something back because they just don't look impressive. And actually, it turns out that testing performance that we were seeing in Bahrain was exactly what the team was experiencing, but also expecting, because they'd basically had some issues in the wind tunnel. I don't know exactly whether that's a correlation problem or that they put stuff into the wind tunnel and it didn't work. But they've had some kind of development logjam, I think, which means that they've come into the start of the season undercooked. They haven't made the progress with the 2021 aero changes with the back of the floor and the diffuser and all of that, those four key changes there. They haven't made as much progress as they wanted there. But I think the fundamental aero development of the car has stalled as well, because they had this problem in the tunnel over the winter. So I don't think the 21 car is where they need it to be. I don't think it's where they wanted it to be, or maybe planned it to be when they were sort of looking. Because obviously the teams map out their development timelines and stuff so far in advance that it would have been ages ago that they'd have had, right, okay, well, we'll have this spec at testing and we'll try this. And then for the first race, we'll have something else. But the main thing is that they've now got to a point where they're having to develop to solve problems rather than develop to sort of fight in the midfield, if you see what I mean. They've got to bring upgrades just to catch up with the opposition, let alone actually establish themselves at the front of the midfield. So I think they're in a really difficult position, and the team has characterised it as needing more than just a few upgrades to get that car where it needs to be. So I don't think these are problems that have a quick fix. I think that they've probably been there for a few months now, and I think it's another worrying sign for this team, because obviously they had a messy winter with the management reshuffle and everything, and it looks a little bit of a mess at the moment, to be completely honest.
That's a strange thing with that team, isn't it? It's had moments and stretches. There was a period last season where it looked like things were really back together, and on the up again, and then it faded a bit. But Mark, we know there's good people there. It's a team that's got reasonable resources as well, decent facilities. Why do you think it's not quite coming together there?
I think a lot of it's legacy. I think, you know, it's been trying to catch up for the last, since Renault came back in 17. And I think probably a lot of the focus is on 22. And we know that the power unit plant in Viry has been completely transformed, and that starts operating this month, actually. So there's probably a lot of work going on there. There's probably a lot of work going on the whole 22 project. And I'm sure that a certain amount of time was allocated to the 21 car, not in the expectation that it was going to be as far off as it is, but I don't really see that they are going to want to suddenly start diverting resource from the 22 project onto this car. And if it can't be tweaked into reasonable shape, I think they'll just have to live with it for the balance of this season.
Yeah, that would be the logical thing to do. I guess the big question is, if there are weaknesses in this car that are fundamental to the way the team operates, i.e. things they need to troubleshoot and learn to stop them carrying over into next year's car, that's when it gets a bit more complicated, doesn't it? Sometimes you have things that are kind of localised to a 21 car, in which case, fine, you just live with it. But if there's something that they know is related to their fundamental process, or that they suspect could be but aren't sure, then it becomes much, much more difficult. But they're certainly right to look at the long term.
It's not the first time, though, with the sort of this iteration of Enstone that we've had these weird sort of development plateaus. Was it 2019 when Cyril Abitbol was promising that fancy aero upgrade package at Paul Ricard, and he was, I think he was in Monaco, and he was saying, "Oh, you know, people expect so much of us. I don't know why they expect so much of us. By the way, for the French Grand Prix, we're going to have a package that's worth 4 seconds, and we're going to be amazing." But that's a massive embellishment. But I'm pretty sure he was promising quite a significant performance step from that, and it just didn't happen. And then, if memory serves, their development wasn't that impressive at all through 2019. So, is it just the sort of organisation where if you get it right, you don't get it right in a spectacular way, and then you get it wrong and you fall behind, and it's just these really measured sort of peaks and troughs where they don't fall a huge amount behind, but they never really star, but they are definitely oscillating in terms of form. I don't feel like they're a particularly dependable midfield team.
Yeah, you don't have huge confidence in them as a result. I mean, that 2019 thing, the problem they had, they just couldn't get anything new out of the barge boards when they made modifications. The whole car wasn't kind of very well joined up aero-wise, so they hit a wall and they had to do the next year's car. Obviously, they did the slender nose last year, which did work. But yeah, you want to see that consistent improvement. And although, as Mark said, the legacy problems they had, because that team was hugely underinvested in before Renault took it over a long time. So there was a lot for them to rebuild. But they kind of got the low-hanging fruit to get up to a certain level. And we thought, this is all looking very good. They're taking, you know, one step after another. They got up to fourth in the championship. And then they've just sort of, it's like they just sort of hit that ceiling and are just sort of floating around underneath it, bouncing around between fourth, fifth, sixth best. So Mark, when you look at it, do you think there's any reason to be confident in them? Is it just that it takes such a long time now with Formula One that it will need something like 2022 to let that team have a fair reset? Or do you think there are more fundamental problems that need to be solved?
I'm sure they will identify the basic trickiness in the aero that's causing it to misbehave at certain speed ranges. But in terms of, as Scott said earlier, that's just catching up to the others, isn't it? And in terms of them suddenly joining that fight with McLaren, Ferrari, AlphaTauri, no, it doesn't look like it. I would expect them to just continue in this sort of no man's land that they are really. It's not no man's land, really, is it? It's roughly in the territory that Aston Martin's also in, that Alfa Romeo might be in on a good day, that Williams can aspire to. It's that sort of area. It's a sort of back third of the grid, really. The front end of the back third, if you like. And I think the gap up to that next little group of McLaren, Ferrari and Tauri is quite a significant chunk. And I think to be thinking you're going to be able to claw that back and, you know, and some more, I don't think is I wouldn't be confident in expecting that.
I think we need to establish exactly what the nature of this issue they've had in the wind tunnel over the winter is, because that's not a particularly encouraging thing to hear from a team that's banking an awful lot on new regulations, is it, for next year? If you're in the process of developing a brand new car to brand new technical rules, and you're coming off a winter where you haven't been able to develop your known car the way you wanted, that's not going to inspire a huge amount of faith in the processes, is it?
No, it's very true. So I think until we know more detail from the inside, I think it's hard to sort of make a dependable sort of, looking forward to have any sort of idea of where they're going to be.
And how about Alonso? Obviously, he'll be a little bit frustrated with the competitiveness of the car. I know he wasn't expecting wins and podiums to be happening much this year, but, well, wins certainly not at all. But obviously he's had a mixed start to the season. Bahrain wasn't too bad before he had some problems. Imola was a tricky one, and he had quite a difficult race at Imola, actually. All sorts of issues, got passed by Mick Schumacher a couple of times, had a spin under the safety car, a number of offs. It was quite a messy weekend for Alonso, who was very frank about his own weaknesses. But Scott, do you think anyone should be worried about Alonso? Obviously, there's some people queuing up to say, oh, it just shows he's past it. Personally, I don't subscribe to that. But do you think there's any concern there?
Well, he did say throughout the winter that it would take a few races for him to feel like he was at that level. And I think Sergio Perez put it quite well after qualifying on Saturday, Imola, that was probably the worst track you could go to, or one of the worst tracks you could go to early in your phase of acclimatizing to a team and car, because it's a track that rewards confidence and punishes hesitance. So, and Alonso looked like the embodiment of that over the course of the weekend. So I'm willing to sort of give him the benefit of the doubt and say it might have been circuit specific. I know that he says he can't rely on that as an excuse, and he's absolutely right. But if you look at how well he did in Bahrain, you know, he did haul that car into Q3, and he was enjoying himself early on racing inside the top 10. Obviously, he was slipping back before the sandwich wrapper, I think, ruined his race. But I feel like there was enough shown in Bahrain already to believe that this is a guy who can go back to his sort of hustling best. I just think Imola was a particularly challenging weekend, and we saw exactly the same from Daniel Ricciardo, another guy who looked really solid for much of the Bahrain weekend, and then suddenly was 3/10 adrift of Lando Norris pretty much the entire time at Imola, and then smashed to pieces in the final stint of the Grand Prix. So, you know, Alonso, Ricciardo, these guys haven't become bad drivers, and Ricciardo doesn't even have the excuse of being out of Formula One for the last two seasons, does he? So all of this put together makes me feel like we can, at the moment, treat Imola as a bit of a special case. Portugal's going to be difficult because I guess he needs to get up to speed at that track. It's worth remembering that Alonso didn't race at Imola last year like all the others, and he wouldn't have raced at Algarve either. So there's an element at play there. Do we need to wait for Barcelona? That feels like a decent sort of line in the sand to draw. If he's 2 or 3 tenths off Ocon there and racing poorly, making mistakes, then I think maybe you can say this isn't a very encouraging position for his comeback to be in. At the moment, it would be too premature to say that he's genuinely struggling or not going to get back to the levels we've seen in the past.
Do you think, Mark, with things not starting so well for Alpine, Alonso will be starting to get a little bit worried about the decision he's made? Obviously, he'll have a very good read on what's going on there. He's obviously saying all the right things at the moment. He's still got to concentrate on getting himself up to speed. But how concerned do you think he might be already?
I think in the back of his mind, he'll have to be concerned. In the forward bit of his mind, he's got to keep motivation. He's got to keep questions like that at bay. But it's inevitable that there will be in there somewhere. What am I doing here? I've been I'm running out of time and I'm in an uncompetitive situation. So, yeah, it's bound to be playing on him. But in terms of his own personal performance, no, I don't think he's particularly behind his own schedule in that. And if you look at all the new guys, all the experienced new guys experienced guys in new teams, they're all struggling. You know, there's him, as you said, there's Perez, Ricciardo, Vettel, Sainz. They're all about the same chunk off their incumbent teammates. So I guess that's just what you get with 1.5 days of pre-season preparation in very complex cars. I wondered as well, each of those five drivers, they've all not just changed teams, they've changed power units. And these are extremely sophisticated but complicated bits of kit to operate. And I wonder how much of it is that as well. Not just the car, but the power unit. Because every one of them has gone to a different power unit. So I think, yes, he's going to have natural concerns about where the team is at and what its potential is. It will be staking a lot on 22. He'll be wanting to know exactly what's gone wrong this year that can be, attended to in time to make sure that the 22 car is not fundamentally flawed in the same way. And I think he'll be relatively satisfied with his own progress, but yeah, I think sort of Barcelona, as Scott said, sounds like a reasonable time probably to take a reading on that latter aspect.
I would add that at the moment, what we're hearing from Alonso is he does seem to genuinely be enjoying the experience at the moment. I know he was very critical of his own performance over the course of the Imola weekend, but everything else around that, he does seem to be someone who is just fundamentally enjoying being back Grand Prix racing again. I know, Ed, you mentioned that, you know, he's saying all the right things about the team, but I mean more about the experience of being back in Formula One, qualifying, driving these cars in qualifying in Bahrain. I remember he was quite effusive in his praise, and then Imola as well. I think, Mark, you spoke to him after qualifying? I think at Imola. He doesn't seem to be someone whose head's dropped, even though he didn't exactly have a particularly enjoyable weekend in terms of performance.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's fair. But we are only two races into the comeback, so you know there'll be a honeymoon period because it will be great to be back after that time away. Just to be actually back, being a Formula One driver, doing all the things you remembered doing that were starting to fade a little bit from the memory. I'm sure it's still an enjoyable experience, but the competitive animal will start demanding a bit more than that quite soon, I think.
Another 21 weekends spent driving a shed is probably going to bring the worst out of him, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I think in his second stint at McLaren, I think although he had those rants about the engine over the radio, there was nobody in the team that felt he was a demotivating force or he didn't demotivate anyone. They all thought he was great to work with. So I think he's a lot more mature than he was in his first McLaren season. And I think a lot of the reputation goes back to there and his first stint.
And ultimately, he knows time's against him, so he can't afford to have any period where he's not giving his best, because he's got to get the most out of the Alpine opportunity. There's a tiny chance that some bigger team might need a driver of his calibre if something weird happens in the driver market. That'll be in the back of his mind. So he's got to deliver a consistently high level for Alpine to show that he's back to his best in the not-too-distant future, just to maximise the chances, because you know, he's pushing 40 now, so time is against him. So he needs to deliver. Scott, of those drivers we've mentioned, the newcomers, which one do you think's made the best start, all things considered?
Who are the newcomers?
Vettel, Aston
Alonso,
Martin,
Alonso,
Ricciardo,
Vettel,
yeah.
Perez, Sainz, Ricciardo. Okay. I was going to try and find a sarcastic way to say Vettel, but I can't put him through that. He's not having a great time. I think all round, I would say I've been really impressed by Sainz. I felt like he wasn't. He was sort of like in the middle after testing. He didn't seem quite like where Ricciardo and Alonso were, but he definitely wasn't having or talking in the way that Perez and Vettel were. Qualifying, I feel like he sort of extracted some performance that was quite impressive. Obviously, Imola he was less satisfied with, but he's driven really smartly. He's banked a load of points for the team. So I think probably him or Ricciardo, because Perez, I was really impressed by that step and then the actual result in qualifying at Imola, but he did feel he should have got pole. Max made a mistake, and I think as you wrote on the race website, Ed, I think the error-strewn and slightly difficult race was evidence of the fact that he's not comfortable and he's got a way to go. So it's probably between Sainz and Ricciardo, and actually I was probably slightly more impressed by Sainz overall at Imola than I was Ricciardo. But yeah, either of those two, I find it a bit hard to split them, to be honest.
It feels like, well, Ricciardo just had a bit of a slow weekend at Imola relative to Norris, didn't he? And I actually think Ricciardo did well in the race to come out with that sixth place, because he was struggling, but he kept it clean and was rewarded with a pretty decent result. Whereas Sainz in the race was pretty close to his qualifying pace is the area for Sainz that he's really got to work on. He was saying that he feels like he can do, he knows how to drive all the corners, but stringing it all together was particularly tricky. And Imola, as we've said, is a tricky circuit to get everything right at. But yeah, I think I'd be inclined to agree. I would say I don't think Imola Vettel was too bad. His race was okay. He had lots of misfortune that was nothing to do with him. But yeah, definitely Ricciardo and Sainz are the ones who are creating the most impression. But Mark, you mentioned how complicated these cars are. I know we've seen a lot of responses when we've run stories on the race website about people taking time to adapt, people just saying, oh, it's just excuse, etc. But it's incredibly complicated, isn't it? Understanding all the little tricks of these cars, not just how the power unit works, how the car behaves and handles, how the team works, all your diff maps and brake shapes and all these things. There's a hell of a lot just to take on board so you can apply it as second nature, isn't there?
Yeah, you've got to get it so it's like muscle memory. It's just automatic. All, you know, any change that needs to be made, any adaptation that needs to be made, or a different track surface or temperature, or, you know, or a different handling trade or a different stage of the race or different tyre management. These all things are a driver that's incumbent in that team that's got used to the systems and has got used to the feel of the cars. Are just going to be doing second nature, and the new driver is going to have to be sort of thinking about it always sort of half a step behind. And that impacts upon your confidence, and the confidence thing impacts upon how much rotation you feel you can take in, particularly the slow corners, how aggressive you can be in getting the car to rotate early. And that, you know, determines how late you can feel confident braking, how early you can get on the power. All these things, and just lap time bleeds away before you even know it. So, yeah, it's a lot, and it's a complicated process, particularly with these cars, with these power units and these tires. It is very, very complex. So, I think you're seeing probably Imola was probably the biggest challenge that those guys new to those teams are going to face. But you know, if we're talking about the guys that are new to a particular team or a particular car, a particular power unit. But, you know, for the rookies, it's if those guys have got those problems, think what it's like for the rookies.
We had a couple of messages over the last few days, because obviously we had this theme at Imola of these new guys or the guys that had moved teams struggling more there. And a couple of people pointed out and said, oh, you know, does this make what Nico Hülkenberg did as a stand-in last year more impressive? Does it make what George Russell did for Mercedes at the Sakhir Grand Prix more impressive? And my position on that is like not to me, because like this is why we were saying they did such a good job last year. And so many people viewed their performances cynically. With Russell, it was, oh, this just shows how great the Mercedes is and how easy Lewis Hamilton has it. And with Hulk, it was, oh, well, this just shows how mediocre Sergio Perez and Lance Stroll is. That car should be doing way better than it normally is. And when we were sort of going into the detail of like listening to some of the feedback they were giving over the radio, actually watching how they went about their programs and just hearing from the people who were working closely with them about how they prepared and then actually executed those opportunities. That's why we thought they did a mega job last year, because that is not an easy thing to do. And the difference between guys like that and then a situation where these guys are all trying to get up to speed is partly, I think, there's an element of the pressure, because when you go in and you do those one-offs, I don't think there are any expectations really. So while in Russell's case, for example, there was the wider career context, I still think in that exact situation, you have people that aren't necessarily expecting a great deal of you because it's so difficult. So that makes it fractionally easier. And I also think at the moment with the guys who have switched teams now, you're being benchmarked against teammates who are so well established. I mean, that doesn't make it any easier. If you look at, especially for Perez, Ricciardo and Sainz, they're up against three teammates who not only know the team really well, but they're young guys who are in great form. So it's a very different situation to the guys we saw adapting last year on one-off basis.
Yeah, slightly different comparisons to be made there, and I think you've explained it fairly well there. But in terms of the outright newcomers, the rookies, one driver we haven't spoken about a great deal is Mick Schumacher, Scott. Obviously, Haas has had a predictably difficult start to the season with Schumacher and Nikita Mazepin down at the back. Schumacher's had his moments in races, spin in Bahrain, crash under the safety car at Imola. How would you evaluate the start of his F1 career so far, beyond the fact he's always started 18th and finished 16th?
And spun on his way to finishing there. Yeah, I think if not for those spins, I'd actually say he's been quietly quite impressive. The thing I found frustrating about the spin at Imola wasn't so much the fact that he nosed it into the wall under the safety car, because as stupid as it does look, it is understandable how that can happen. The reason it frustrated me is because it undid a really good weekend's work. If that event took place without that spin, then his weekend would have been smashing Nikita Mazepin on pace from FP2 to the end of the Grand Prix, qualifying pretty respectably in the context of that tight fight to get out of Q1. I think he was only three or four tenths off of a Q2 place, and overtaking Fernando Alonso twice in the Grand Prix, once on the opening lap, and then later on when when Mick had come in and changed onto slick tyres, he pulled a... I was expecting him to end up in the gravel at Rivazza, because coming out of Variante Alta, he got a great run on Alonso, who was on fading inters, and then Mick went offline to dive to the right of him on the run down the hill, and I thought that was just going to end in tears. So you have these moments where you're like, okay, well, this was really impressive. You know, really good pace here, really sensible driving there, a bit of aggression in places when it's sensible to be aggressive. And it's just such a shame that these pockets of performance we're only seeing in the context of he has spun already in this Grand Prix. So the race is compromised. And he's a rookie. He's in a difficult car, difficult position. The conditions were bad and very tricky at Imola. I'm interested to see now we get into the season, sort of once now he's got a couple of full weekends under his belt, get rid of those errors and let's see sort of what he's actually capable of, because this is a little bit too similar to the Mick we saw in F2, which is you believe that there is a guy there who's capable of being quick but is also a good racing driver. But there's also capacity for a little mistake to creep in. But he's made his mistake in dirty air. He's made his mistake on difficult tyres, let's call them difficult, in hard conditions. So don't make those mistakes again and hopefully avoid any new mistakes. And then I think we might actually be seeing the start of a relatively impressive rookie season.
And I think we shouldn't underestimate the fact that he's had such a decisive pace advantage over Mazepin. You might say, oh, well, Nikita Mazepin, clearly Schumacher's a better driver. But we shouldn't forget, Mazepin's been driving F1 cars, going back to as long ago as 2016, he was driving around in Force Indias. He's done quite a few test days. He had that whole private testing program with Mercedes. So he's got plenty of experience in terms of test mileage, far, far, far more F1 mileage than Mick Schumacher has. So for Schumacher to be so comprehensively outpacing him is I think, a pretty good effort. But, yeah, it's going to be a long season for him toiling at the back. But I think a solid start. But I agree, yeah, it's a shame that that pretty good Imola weekend was undermined by a pretty horrible error because, yeah, plenty of drivers have had that blunder. But it's still not good when you go off under the safety car. Moving a little bit more back up the field again, we talked in our Imola review podcast about the fallout from that Bottas-Russell incident. Since then, Russell's made his apologies and climbed down a little. You wrote a piece that ran on the race's website, delving into what we learned from the whole thing. So now the dust's settled, what have we actually understood about Russell and his future, and what can we take from what happened at Imola?
I think what we saw at Imola was just really on the cards. If ever in the unlikely event that that George found himself actually wheel to wheel with Valtteri. It was very unlikely because of how much quicker the Mercedes is than the Williams, but it came together at Imola in that way because of the tyre warm-up problems that Valtteri was having, which isn't just a small problem. If you can't get to them to that crucial threshold of temperature, you are miles off, you are whole seconds off, you're not tenths off. Yeah, he was in that situation. George is in a Williams that's actually much improved. He was, you know, both of those cars got through to Q2 in Imola. So, you know, let's say you've got a situation there where it was just about possible they might be fighting over the same bit of track, and they were. And I don't think George could do anything other than attempt a move. When he's on hotter tyres, he's got DRS, he's got 20 miles an hour advantage on him, and it's coming up to the only feasible overtaking spot on the circuit. So he went for the move, and it didn't work. And I think that's all that happened, really. It was just that. You can talk about whether Valtteri squeezed him or not. I don't think he did, really. It's just where George was expecting Valtteri to be and sort of try to make a little bit too much allowance. And that's all that happened. But in terms of how it's impacted upon his future, I don't think significantly. In fact, it may even be that the reason that Toto was so annoyed was because in his head, George has already got the 2022 driver. And, you know, he didn't need to do it. He didn't need to be making up one more place. So Toto's thinking about it, I think, from the perspective of the boss saying, stop trying to impress me, stop giving me problems. But George can't be thinking like that from in the car. George is racing. He's racing not for Mercedes, he's racing for Williams. So he's got to take the opportunity. The opportunity's right there in front of him, and he goes for it. And I think that's... a good sign. I would have had far more questions about George had he backed out of that move than he went for the move and it didn't work.
Yeah, well, people would be complaining that he doesn't have like the killer instinct, wouldn't they? Where people would have been saying, "Oh, well, you know, he can't cut it. He's not brave enough, not bold enough," and all of this. I think just to further to Mark's point about it not necessarily affecting his future. I think the fact that George and Toto clearly had a conversation in between George's still quite emotional comments, even after the race on Sunday, and that statement coming out. That statement was very much, that was just typical of George, wasn't it? I suspect in his heart of hearts, he still doesn't believe he was in the wrong, but I think he's probably just... after the fact is now when he's, you know, Toto's talking about that, having that global perspective behind the wheel. I'm inclined to agree with Mark and say that's an unreasonable expectation. But I think George does have a tremendous global perspective outside of the car. And I'm sure while having that conversation with Toto before it, after it, while he's thinking about it, he'll have thought the most sensible thing for me to do here is accept that the person who may decide my future has a slight disagreement with me over this. And it makes sense for me to play the magnanimous card and say, yeah, okay, I'll like eat a bit of humble pie here because it will help me out further down the line. To me, anyway, the statement had the air of someone who had sort of accepted that it was the right and sensible thing to do. I think with the way that George was talking on Sunday evening, I can't believe that he would suddenly just decide, actually, no, do you know what? Completely on me, my bad, guys. I think he sort of accepted that the smart thing to do there is to climb down a little bit.
Yeah, it's to his benefit to put it all to bed. There'll still be questions of it when we get to Algarve, but it's not going to be such a big thing. So you say, well, we've dealt with it. We've had the sort of final climb down. And yeah, I think those thinking it's going to impact his future with Mercedes. Mercedes will pick him if they think he's the best driver. He's still the same driver. He was still a very, very good driver. So I don't think it's going to significantly impact his chances of that seat next year. And I think, as Mark has said before, he's probably the most likely Mercedes driver to be in the car in 2022, given the contract situation of the others. Scott, the on-again, off-again Miami Grand Prix is back on again for 2022. The circuit, different to the original plan. So are you confident F1 has finally got that long-awaited second American race firmly set?
Well, I'll correct you. The circuit's not different to the original plan. The circuit is different to the one that was different to the one that was different to the one that was different to the original plan. I think it has changed. I think it's the fourth or fifth variant now. It's even changed since the final change last year when they moved it completely off of public roads and onto private grounds. The circuit originally that they were planning within the Miami Dolphins NFL stadium grounds, it went left and then back round to the right, and now it just goes right at turn one. So they've even changed the first corner now. But I think we are now at a point where this race, we should plan on this race happening. It has the deal. It's on we knew that they'd had a 10-year deal in principle, but I guess they were waiting for the race to actually start before that 10-year period began. They got the blessing of the local authority in the build-up to the Imola weekend. That was quite significant. It's taken a $5 million investment package around sort of community engagement and leaving a more positive cultural legacy on the area, and putting in the sort of structure that allows for young students to get engaged in different industries for apprenticeships and stuff like this. And so that's all well and good. I think they're still going to have loads of opposition. I remember when I was working in Formula E and reporting on the Battersea Park saga, and being in endless Wandsworth Council meetings because of the opposition locally to the race happening. And these people don't give up. That they'll lose one battle and they'll come back for the next one. So F1's going to have people with strong opposing views that they'll be voicing every day or every week between now and the race happening for the first time. And when the race happens for the first time and there are traffic problems and it's loud and all of this, people will be up in arms again, and they'll use that as grounds to argue even harder afterwards. So if F1 wants to race in Miami for the next 10 years, it has to prepare itself for 10 years of aggravation, because unfortunately it's found an area in Miami Gardens where the locals really aren't sold on it, or some of the locals really aren't sold on it. It's never the majority, and the people who have something to say, as my Twitter mentions feed can attest, and the YouTube comments can sometimes attest as well, it's normally the people who have something bad to say are the ones that shout the loudest. So all that said and done, F1's very happy to get this over the line. Miami's very happy to get this over the line. They're saying it's not a compromise moving it into the NFL stadium. I think by definition it's a compromise because it's not what they originally wanted. So that there is that. I think that the final version of the circuit is probably a minor improvement over the street circuit that they started with, just because that was so 90 degree corners left and right, really long straight tight hairpin, just unimaginative and quite boring. I don't think that this circuit's going to be particularly great for racing, but let's see. But I think the bottom line is the project's real now. Before it was just setback after setback after setback, and F1 was almost just like pig-headedly cracking on with this pipe dream. But it is real. The contract's done. I think we're going to Miami in 2022, which is pretty cool. If we do go there next year, it'd be interesting to see how many times we go back.
America and Formula One have had an uneasy relationship over the years. Obviously, Austin seems to have become a fairly stable home for the United States Grand Prix. So there's been this push for that second race. Remember, there was the New Jersey race that was going to happen for some years and never quite came off. All sorts of projects. Do you think this is kind of sustainable for the US to have two races? And is it actually important for F1, do you think, to have that firm foothold there?
It's desirable. It can manage without, I'm sure, but it's desirable. It expands the market. Austin is a fantastic venue. It's a fantastic racetrack. Just unfortunate that they struggle to make a lot of money from it. So in terms of the business side of it, perhaps something needs to be tweaked there. But yeah, I think if you can get two US races to be commercially viable, I think it's only a good thing for Formula One. And I also like that the organizers and F1 between them, in the case of Miami, have gone quite a long way to addressing the concerns. You know, they're setting up apprenticeship schemes for locals down there in high schools, engineering, related to the sport. So I think there's the will to make it happen from Formula One itself is very strong, and I think Miami would be in many ways a perfect venue to have that second race. But I just hope it's not at the expense of Austin, because that's such a brilliant track and a brilliant venue.
Yeah, Austin's just a great place. I hope we'll be going there for many, many years. But if history tells us anything, it's that the United States Grand Prix is a slightly nomadic entity. It's been all over the place over the years. First held in Georgia, wasn't it? The original one back in 1907, 1908 sort of time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was on sort of private land, sort of the grand prize, Savannah.
Yeah, certainly perhaps not something to go back to, but yeah, it's amazing that whole history. You can probably have a look online and find all the circuits that have held Grand Prix racing of one form or another in the United States. There's no lack of them. Well, thanks very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes, for your insight. Loads to read on the race.com website. Don't forget the hyphen if you're heading there, from everyone, and also Gary Anderson and the rest of the race team. Check out our YouTube channel as well there. Lots to watch. And also our sister podcast, Bring Back V10s. We're now going to turn our attention to Portugal, and Mark's going to try and make his way there. Good luck in your travels, and we'll bring you everything you need to know about the Portuguese Grand Prix after the race.